I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to sports, there's no arguing that men hold the greatest number of jobs both on and off the fields of play. Today, we get a sense for where women are in this competitive industry, from one woman's vow to never hire another male coach, to the voices announcing games on national TV, not as athletes but as sportscasters, coaches, and managers for college and pro teams. Then we're joined by U.S. Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri. We'll get his take on the Mueller report, ask about the support available for recent flood victims in the state, and detail his bill to study the impact of technology and media on children. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Notre Dame women's basketball coach Muffet McGraw has had enough. The number of women coaching women collegiate teams is shrinking, and shrinking dramatically. McGraw says that men rule the world, and now they are increasingly ruling women's collegiate sports as well, and she doesn't like it. It's important, she said, that young women learn how to lead by watching other women do it. That's why she won't hire a man on her coaching staff. That got us to thinking about women in sports in general, in the front office, in coaching, in the journalism of covering sports, where change has, in fact, come to some degree. Now a conversation about women in sports, and with us, Kenitra Pulliams is a freelance reporter. Kenitra, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
Greg Eklund covers sports for KCUR. Greg, nice to have you.
Good to be here, Steve.
We hope to have Dana Welniak with KCTV5 Sports as well. You know, Kenitra, what about what Muffet McGraw had to say about never hiring a male coach on her staff? She wants young women to experience women in leadership. What do you make of her stand here?
It's admirable to have someone to definitively, you know, kind of put her foot down and say what is needed, because you want to give somebody else a chance to have the same opportunity in which she's, you know, enjoyed, an NCAA championship coach, a Hall of Famer. And if you don't get a chance, then you never get the opportunity to ascend to the top level in your respective sport.
Do you think there's something to the fact that she says that she wants her women athletes to see how women lead?
You have to have a role model, and it's not just at the coaching level. You need female athletic directors and chancellors and vice presidents and board of education so that they can give, you know, those who have been overlooked the chance to start maybe and work their way up the ladder to where they can be in leadership positions.
How are her remarks being interpreted and covered by the media, Greg? What have you noticed?
Well, I noticed that obviously that there was a lot of play in the media from this, because she is a Hall of Fame coach, as Kenitra had mentioned.
And was very outspoken.
She was very outspoken, and she had the platform to do it, because they were Notre Dame was at the women's Final Four. It was probably of the women's major sports, women's basketball is the high profile event, and it's on the same weekend as the men's Final Four, and so she had the platform to speak out on this. I would mention that I did a story on this actually a year ago for KCUR, and we had talked about this very issue. But at that time, that was we were covering we included basketball, but we had also, this is not just in basketball; it's also in softball, women's softball. It's also in women's volleyball. It's the same in other sports, but it didn't get the play because of the platform that Muffet McGraw has.
You know, Kenitra, I'm just struck by these statistics that show pretty conclusively that more men are coaching women's teams these days, not just basketball, but across the spectrum of women's sports. What's going on?
I just think it's just kind of systemic. That's kind of the way it's always been. And change is happening, but very, very slowly. You know, you look at Tennessee and just the legend that Pat Summitt established, you know, coaching women's basketball. And, you know, now Kelly Jolly Harper, former Tennessee player, you know, took Missouri State to the NCAA tournament, had a great run. And now she has been hired to take over the Tennessee program. But there's still, I mean, you look at UConn, and they are kind of the epitome of what women's college basketball excellence is. And, you know, Gino Auriemma, as great as he is, I mean, he's a man coaching a women's college basketball team. So it's happening little by little, but still it's not, I don't think enough people are raising issue with men coaching women.
I'm just really struck by the fact, though, Greg, that it was just a few years ago, a decade or so, where there were more women coaching women's teams, and now the trend has reversed itself, which suggests that something's going on out
well,
there.
Well, I think there are a lot of better-paying women's sports positions now, and a lot of men are seeking those better-paying. And to illustrate the point that Kenitra had brought up earlier, you still have men hiring and making the hires in these athletic departments. So it really is, and there is a group here in Kansas City that is very active out there that is trying to change that, is trying to get more female administrators making the hires.
Dana Welniak, you know, clearly it seems, though, that there are a lot of schools that don't agree with Notre Dame women's basketball coach Muffet McGraw. They're willing to hire men and let go a chance to hire women to lead their women's teams. What's your theory as to why that is?
Well, that's a good question, because I think that I agree with a lot of the stuff that you guys have already said, in the fact that I think there are still some preconceived notions out there that it needs to be a father figure in that role rather than a motherly figure. And
that seems counterintuitive to me.
See, and a lot of people, I think that's changing. I do think that's changing. But I think from a leadership standpoint, a lot of people still see that. But back to Greg's point, in that there are multiple areas, multiple colleges, whether it's the pro level, whether it's even the high school level, they're trying to get more females into those coaching roles, into those leadership roles. And even at the NFL level, they had a big convention just recently at the NFL Combine just for women to try to network and get into NFL coaching roles and administrative roles. So while some people still see it as that old school, you know, fatherly figure needs to be the coaching perspective, there are still a lot of people out there that think the other way around.
You know, I've got to ask this question, Kenitra. You know, if men are so welcome as coaches of women's teams, why aren't women welcome to coach men's teams? Because you see even fewer women involved at that level.
I think it's because the perception that, well, if you didn't play the sport, namely football, then how can you coach the sport? How can, you know, yes, women, and I mean, you know, Danny played.
Is there anything
football.
To be said for that?
It's old school thinking. Mm-hmm. It's not valid thinking. It's just you have to change the mindset before you can change the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just this patriarchal society where there's a perception that men can do it better.
Danny, that is changing. And again, you did play pro football on a women's team. That we have women's coaches now in the NFL, and that's a first.
And that's what's crazy about that, too, is that both of the women that have made those impacts I've played with. So Katie Sowers is the receivers coach for the 49ers. She's the first full-time women's coach. Jen Welter was one of the intern coaches for the Arizona Cardinals, I believe. So she did stuff in the offseason programs with them and was actually the first female coach in the National Football League. And I think that is, to Kenitra's point, you've got to go in and change that mindset. And now that women are getting an opportunity to play football and the coaches in the women's leagues are becoming better, they're more knowledgeable, they're teaching better, we're getting the same kind of learning experience that a lot of these men had at a younger age, and we're learning the game just as well as the guys are. So you're able to go into that locker room now and say, I took a hit just like you. I've had that experience just like you guys have. Yeah, it may not have been to that kind of extent, but you're still getting the basis of it. You know what it's like to have a concussion or to deal with hits and feel that pain of having a season-ending injury, or the highs of having an amazing catch or an amazing touchdown, and the lows of you know, embarrassing yourself, but then being able to come back from it. So you can relate to the athletes on that level.
Greg Eklund, what do we know about how those female NFL assistant coaches are faring? What's any sense of how the players are responding to them? Have you seen coverage of that?
Well, there has been coverage of it. They're in the very early stages because this is very new. So much of it needs time to play itself out, especially mm-hmm. in the Arizona situation. They're going through a lot of transitions mm-hmm. With Arizona. They have a new head coach. They have the number one pick in the draft. So there are a lot of things going on in Arizona where this is a situation that is not getting a lot of focus right now because of their position in the NFL draft.
You look at Tampa Bay now. Tampa Bay has two women on staff, full-time on staff. So props to Bruce Arians, who champions the idea and gives credit to the women who are credible and who deserve. They've played the game, and now they're getting an opportunity to come up through the coaching ranks.
Well, and he's the one who also hired Jen, the very first female head coach. Mm-hmm. So you need more coaches like that who don't have the old-school perspective mm-hmm. and can get in there and prove to everyone around, even in his coaching staff, that these women can coach too.
And he's very transparent. He was saying, you know, at the combine when they had the forum for women who want to be in football, how many of you sent me your resume when I was hired in Tampa Bay?
Oh, really? He challenged him.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He said, I read every email. I read every application. I read every resume. Not every coach does that or takes the time to do that. And he says he welcomes, said, I can't know who you are if you don't beat the door down and champion yourself.
Danny, can you picture in your career, before your career ends, will we see a woman coaching an NFL team as head coach?
I think so. I do think so, because I hear the stories of the women who have applied and have applied multiple times for different NFL teams. And just hearing the stories that Katie tells me about how she is championing herself and how she is helping change that perspective. You just need someone to come in there and believe in them as well. And I think that we're getting to that point with coaches like Bruce Arians, and even not necessarily on a female scale, but you're seeing a lot of younger head coaches in the National Football League from a male perspective. And I think that generation also helps.
They will have a different attitude, you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. How about a female NBA head coach?
It's going to happen sooner than in the NFL.
For sure.
You look at Becky Hammon. She's been with the Spurs as a full-time assistant coach since 2014. She coached the Spurs summer league team and led them to a summer league championship. She applied to be the Milwaukee Bucks general manager. She didn't get the job, but she applied for that as well. And so there are a lot of people. I mean, her name is being mentioned right now. Why not Lakers head coach?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting.
You look at Jeannie Buss, who is the owner of the Lakers, a woman. She's in prime position to recognize Becky Hammon and her talent and the dues that she's paid learning under Greg Popovich in San Antonio. Maybe she gets a shot to coach the Lakers.
I'm not sure I'd want to coach LeBron, male, female, or anything else. I think that would just be want to go there?
But you look
is
at
that
LeBron,
a path for success?
Well, you look at LeBron and what he's doing for equality for children, and he supports kind of across the board helping others, the disenfranchised. Yeah. So maybe he would be, well, I don't know LeBron personally to know what he's thinking, but maybe he would be open to the idea of a woman on staff. And if she then, let's say, she becomes Lakers head coach, and then she brings in some of the players that she's coached with and against, those who have Spurs ties. Greg Popovich, there are, I think, 10 or 11 former players or coaches underneath on Popovich's tree who have become head coaches in the NBA.
Sort of like the Andy Reid of the NFL.
Exactly.
Now. Yeah.
So Becky Hammon, I think it's just a matter of time until she will become the first women's head coach in the NBA.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about women and the progress or lack of progress they're making in professional sports. You know, Greg Eklund, what about college athletic directors, pro sports, front office, upper management when it comes to hiring women? How many women are we seeing in those ranks these days?
It's getting better, but not at the pace that they would like for it to be, at least on the college level. And it's actually getting better on the professional level. But I guess I would have to say at the rate that they would probably like to see improved as well.
You know, Danny, tell us, if you would, about your own career path and the challenges that you have faced getting to where you are today.
So one of the great things that I've been very blessed with is the fact that I decided to go into women's professional football. And I originally wanted to be a marine biologist, but decided that I should play pro right out of high school. So the good Lord has opened many doors for me, but I played women's professional football for 5 seasons for the Dallas Diamonds. Helmets, pads, NFL rules, the ball's a little bit smaller and you kick off from 5 yards shorter. So there are a few differences, but it was amazing how much I learned in a short amount of time. And in seeing all of the reporters come to our games and coverage and feature stories that they would do, all the reporters would say how much they loved their job. So I fell in love with that and wanted to do that. So I pursued that. I started off in Dodge City, Kansas, covering high school sports, which was amazing. A lot of travel time. And then I got promoted into Wichita, Kansas, and then up to Kansas City. So,
which is a pretty traditional career path for a journalist, right?
Yeah.
Small market to larger market.
It's not traditional to stay in the same area, though. To be in the Midwest the whole way through my path is very different, because a lot of times in our profession, you have to travel all across the country to move up to different markets.
Yeah.
So that's been great. And the fact that I have a Super Bowl ring, a women's championship ring, the first time I went into a Chiefs locker room, I shook Chris Jones's hand and he grabbed my hand immediately and looked at my hand and my ring and said, "What in the world is that?"
Really?
I said, "Well, it's a women's Super Bowl ring." And we went on talking about it for about 35 minutes in the locker room. And then he would joke with a couple of the other defensive linemen, "Dude, she played. She played football." So then everybody gets to talking. And I think it really helps them respect you being in the locker room.
It's a great story.
So,
Kenitra, how about you? How about your journey?
Kind of like Danny.
You didn't play professional football.
I did not play professional football, but I traveled all over the country. My first job was in Abilene, Texas. And then I went to Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah.
And then now Kansas City. So I wasn't fortunate enough to stay. I'm from Texas. So I didn't stay in Texas my whole journey through.
Yeah.
I've, you know, been different time zones, and you get to see what's important in different regions. I mean, definitely in Texas, football is king. So in Abilene, yes, it was Friday night lights. I mean, we went to Odessa was in our district.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So we would go to Odessa, you know, twice a month,
right,
to, you know, Odessa High, Odessa Permian, and then Richmond, you know, that's when I was introduced to NASCAR.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you have two races in Richmond at RIR as well as Redskins, you know, and then you come back here and it's more of an emphasis college basketball. You know, so you get to see what's, you know, but I don't have a ring. But props to Danny, who, I mean, nobody in the Chiefs locker room, player wise, has a ring. I mean, you have a Super Bowl ring. So that instantly lends credit. Because that's the thing. You get challenged by the people you cover. Like, what do you know about sports? Why do you deserve to be in here? You don't know what you're talking about. So a lot of times you will get challenged.
Well, one of the great underappreciated aspects of my career is my Super Bowl ring from the Patriots in 1989. Something like that, right, Greg? Did you know about my Super Bowl ring?
No,
you didn't. We'll talk about it sometime. Hey, just real quick, in which sports are we most likely to see females in the role of play-by-play announcers?
Well, I think you already see that in the National Basketball Association.
Yes.
You know, the NBA already has them. You are seeing them come into the NFL, so you already have those. I think it's going to be really hard for women to break that barrier in Major League Baseball, and I'm very intrigued by that.
Right. I mean, you have Jessica Mendoza, who's kind of, you know, at the forefront right now with ESPN. But yeah, Doris Burke, she called NCAA tournament games as well as NBA games.
Is Major League Baseball still seen as the last frontier for women?
I think so. I mean, because
though Susan Waldman has made inroads for the New York Yankees.
I mean, and that's it's just hard because, you know, that old mindset of you didn't play Major League Baseball. How can you talk about the game in which you didn't play?
Yeah. We're going to leave our conversation there. No, Danny, you'll be down at the NFL draft this week.
We will.
Coverage. Okay. Danny Welniak again with KCTV 5 Sports. Kenitra Poliams, a freelance reporter. And as always, Greg Eklund, who covers sports for KCUR. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this just in, the National Football League is hiring, but unless you're about 20 years old and have been preparing for the NFL your entire life, you're better off watching the draft live on TV with millions of other fans. Commentator Victor Wishner explains why in this month's edition of A Fan's Notes.
Don't let the calendar fool you. Fans feel that distinct chill in the air, which can only mean one thing. Football season is here.
Pressure now on Mahomes. He's in trouble. Now gets it away. Are you kidding me?
Oh, perhaps you didn't realize that the NFL season officially begins this Thursday night with the first pick of the NFL draft. Of course, in some ways, the season never ended. Coaching changes and free agency moves have dotted the sports headlines off and on since the Super Bowl. One of the most replayed highlights from the Final Four showcased a beaming, biceps-flexing Patrick Mahomes, who, by the way, happens to be launching his own brand of breakfast cereal. Just FYI. The NFL Combine, a week-long affair in which top prospects sprint around in their skivvies for a crowd of coaches and scouts, has become a televised spectacle with play-by-play and color commentary. Even the release of the upcoming schedule got its own 3-hour primetime special on the NFL Network. And now comes the draft. After weeks of speculation and what Sports Illustrated caustically approximates as more than 5 million mock drafts by their own so-called experts. Yes, even the big mockers themselves are mocking all the mocking. On Thursday, ABC, ESPN, and the NFL Network will carry every moment of round one for an expected viewership of more than 11 million. There's no question it's gotten a little ridiculous. After all, this is just a business transaction. For decades, the NFL Player Selection Meeting was a closed-door affair held in the back ballroom of a hotel in New York or Chicago, and only occasionally made it into the next day's sports page. Today, it's a traveling exhibition, with cities bidding to host as if it were, well, the Super Bowl. Kansas City was a finalist to host each of the last 2 years, and the circus may yet come to town, sooner rather than later. The hype is obnoxious, but sports is entertainment, and there's good reason to give in to the fanfare. And not just because the players' duds will be flashier than any uniform. A bright mishmash of pastels, pocket squares, and aspirational bling. There is an inherent fairness to the whole thing. The draft was established in the 1930s as a way to give teams equitable access to players, so that those few with the deepest pockets and most prestigious names couldn't hoard all the talent. The model holds to this day, with the neediest among the league getting first crack at the next superstars. Bernie Sanders, Deion Sanders, that's the kind of socialism that everyone can get behind. But above all, it's a celebration of potential, a concept that, underneath our political and economic inequity, is still woven into our national DNA. What is the American dream other than a stubborn insistence that what could be matters far more than what has been? For all of the league's focus on spectacle and cliches about life-changing moments, the NFL draft actually has lots of them. In one instant, so much fulfillment of a young player's dream, a family's fortunes, maybe even the hopes of an entire city's fan base.
With the 10th pick in the 2017 NFL draft, the Kansas City Chiefs select Patrick Mahomes, the second quarterback.
September will mark the beginning of the NFL's 100th season, the 50th since Kansas City last played in a Super Bowl. So in that context, it's hard not to feel a little sense of urgency. Remember, the first game is only 139 days away.
Victor Wishen is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Just ahead, Missouri Senator Roy Blunt joins me here in the studio. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the program, our political panel discussed what the Democratic Party should be doing to suss out a competitive presidential candidate in 2020. You can hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, learn about the segregation bus tour of Kansas City. It's teaching local high school students how racism is reflected in the physical environments of our region. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, it's not unusual for Missouri Senator Roy Blunt to have a full plate. Right now is no exception. Missouri's senior senator has been working on yet another round of flooding at speeding up the confirmation process for presidential appointees and responding to the release last week of the Mueller report. Senator Blunt joins me here in the studio. And, Senator, always good to have you here.
Hey,
welcome
Steve.
Back.
Good to be with you.
Well, based on your reaction to the release of the Mueller report, you think it's time to put this whole thing behind us?
Well, you know, I don't get to decide that. I think that would be the best thing for the country. And frankly, I think it would be the best thing for Democrats. I think people are just tired of this constant barrage of negative information. We'll see. You know, on the collusion part of the Mueller report, I'm on the Intel committee. We've been looking at this for over 2 years in that committee. And our chairman said a couple of months ago, so I guess I could say it as well, that we'd found nothing that indicates there's any collusion. Frankly, if you look back at the way that campaign ran, it's likely that they weren't capable of collusion. You know, you had a campaign populated with people who had either never done this before or people who, if they were in politics, were kind of on the fringes of politics, in my view. And I think they had one thing going for them, which was a candidate who uniquely understood the frustration that many Americans had at the moment and was willing to fully identify with that. I just don't – I never thought they were capable of it. At the same time, we looked hard to see if they were. And, you know, our report will come out soon after the – we waiting in some extent for the Mueller report to be sure there wasn't something that we had missed. We had shared everything with the Mueller investigators. They had chosen not to share anything with us. That was pretty frustrating for us. But our report will come out, and so that part, I think, clearly it, no surprise to anybody. And on the other parts, you can talk about it a lot, but if Mueller had wanted to do something or make a specific recommendation, he could have. You know, one of the things I said repeatedly during this process, Steve, when the question would come up, well, we should pass a law that says the president can't do anything about Mueller. And I said, no, we shouldn't pass a law. That's the president actually is the president, and we could have created some kind of special counsel the president couldn't do anything about. But when we did that, whether it was Iran-Contra or whatever, or the Clinton Whitewater investigation, that didn't turn out very well for the country. So we decided not to extend that concept, but it would be really a bad idea for the president not to let Mueller come to conclusions here, and he has.
Do you think the report vindicated the president, Senator?
Depends on how you want to read it.
That's right.
I think if it's the bar conclusions of there's no collusion and no obstruction, those are really the two things you'd be looking at. And frankly, you wouldn't even be looking at obstruction if you believed, as the president did from day one, that there'd been no collusion. You know, the danger of these reports is always that somehow it leads you into an area where you intentionally or unintentionally do something you didn't intend to do or shouldn't have done. I think the two top lines are that. People can talk about this, in my view, for as long as they want to, but the president's captured the two top lines, and those are the two lines that really matter. No collusion, no obstruction. There are plenty of other things to disagree with the president on if you're Democrats. The entire Green New Deal. If you want to litigate the next election on the issues, there are plenty of issues to talk about. I think, frankly, that's the better politics talk about the issues.
One of your Republican colleagues, Senator Mitt Romney, issued a statement last week saying he was sickened at the extent and pervasiveness of dishonesty and misdirection by individuals in the highest office of the land, including the president. He added this, reading the report is a sobering revelation of just how far we've strayed from the aspirations and principles of the founders. Do you agree with that?
I don't know that I do. I don't know that. I like Mitt Romney, and I'm pleased to get a chance to serve with him. The overwhelming power of the federal government is an incredible thing. And if you talk to everybody who's ever talked to any individual, including the president, about everything, you're going to find moments when that does not appear to be what my mother would want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
One reason I kind of agreed with I agreed with the Attorney General's determination to redact those things, for instance, about third parties that would just hurt their reputation but weren't illegal. It's not the job of the Justice Department to do that. But in case of looking at these two issues, it apparently was the case of the job to look at everything related. And you're going to find moments that you're not happy with when you do that. Like I said, the president does almost everything my mother said never do. But the president has a lot of positive things to talk about. The economy, number one among them, and he should be doing that. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time analyzing what he said in moments of frustration. And remember, he's thinking the whole time that he didn't do this. That is clear. I read the Mueller report. I haven't read the redacted part, but I read the rest of it. He's clearly thinking from minute one, I didn't do this. The head of the FBI is telling me I'm not under investigation. Why are we doing this to, and I think he largely appears to have always thought it was a response to trying to explain an election defeat by the other side. So, you know, he's frustrated. His background is New York real estate developer, not someone highly steeped in the ways of Washington. And in fact, I heard the president say one day publicly he thought New York real estate was tough till he got to Washington and found out that there was nothing to those guys, that the real tough environment that he'd not expected was just how tough national politics can be.
Missouri Senator Roy Blunt is my guest. One thing the report was unambiguous about, Senator, as you know, was the extent to which Russia did interfere with the 2016 presidential election. What more does this country need to do to address that?
Well, we need to be aware of it. I think we did address it in 2018. Russians continued to try to disrupt our system using largely social media in 2018. And from intelligence and other sources, I know we much more effectively fought back. Remember, until well into the year in 2017, the NSA, the other intelligence agencies were asked questions at one open hearing I was at, as if it was some indictment of this president. Have you been given any direction to have cyber offense? And of course, they said no. But the person who hadn't given any direction to have cyber offense was the previous president, or the first 6 months or so of this presidency. We do have a cyber offensive capacity now to not just defend ourselves, but to also do things that push back. And we need to do that. We need to be working carefully with state and local election officials to be sure that they have the clearances they need to ask questions and get the information they may need.
Are you saying we do need to be offensive when it comes to, I just want to clarify what you're saying.
No, I think not, generally we need to have cyber offense.
Mm-hmm. That capability
at all fronts, whether it's the election infrastructure, our adversaries putting false information out there, whether it's protecting the financial infrastructure or the utilities, the utility infrastructure. We need to have that, and we didn't have that until this president said, I want to develop not just a defensive capability, but we should be fighting back. If they're attacking us, we should be attacking them.
And should we be fighting back, in your view?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. No question about that. Yeah.
I think, if you ask people in the armed services or the intelligence community, what you think the single biggest threat, you might occasionally find that person like Admiral Mullen that says the national debt. But most everybody is going to say cyber. Cyber's the biggest threat. It's always right. been in our military. Our biggest advantage since World War II has always been we were better than anybody else at doing being at the front edge of technology. One reason, Steve, that things like artificial intelligence development is so important, we need to be sure we're able to keep people out of our systems. So we have to have equally good ability to keep them out of our defense systems because they're going to constantly be trying to get in. So, whoever can break the code the quickest has a big advantage. And we need to, frankly, be able to break the code into their systems, too, if we ever get into a situation where we're really in active warfare or somebody's threatening to critical to impact our electricity system in the country or to take satellites out. All those things can be very crippling, both economically and health-wise and in every other way. And so a cyber offense is really important, and don't think it gives away any secrets today in the Intel Committee. That's one of the things we focus on the most, and fighting back to keep people out of our election structure, whether it's the actual vote counting structure, which nobody has at this point believes has been compromised in any way, or just the false information structure. It's one thing for Americans to take advantage of their First Amendment rights and put false information out there. It's another thing from people from other countries
right.
who aren't protected by the First Amendment to be putting false information out and acting like it's real information.
Hey, how concerned should our listeners be? How concerned should Americans be at the sanctity and safety of the 2020 election coming up in terms of Russian interference from anybody, Senator?
Well, I think you're going to see, we saw in 2018 interference from the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, right. the Iranians. We're likely to see all of that again. And some of it is having some skepticism about everything you see and everything you hear, to be sure that you really are looking at facts that appear to make sense. And if they don't, you're checking out to see whether they make sense. The one thing I think you can have real confidence in is the commitment of the federal government to help state and local officials as they try to be sure that the vote counting, whatever happens on election day, is what really happened. And while there's a federal role to play there, and I chair the committee in the Senate that oversees that federal role, while there's a federal role to play there, the very diversity of our system, this would be almost an exact Barack Obama quote in 2016, where he says the very diversity of our election infrastructure is one of the great strengths of our system.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to federalize that, but I do think there's a helpful federal role, and I believe we're working to see that role is properly fulfilled.
Your colleague in the Senate from Missouri, Josh Hawley, is calling for a special counsel to investigate potential misconduct by the FBI dating back to Trump's 2016 campaign. What do you make of that idea?
There's a lot of frustration about what happened in the 2016 campaign at the FBI level, at the so-called Steele dossier level, at the level where you get FISA warrants to listen to conversations, and you do that based on information that turns out not to have been accurate or mm-hmm. not even factual in any way. I think that Chairman Graham and the Judiciary Committee is likely to look at this topic. I'm not a big special prosecutor proponent, but Senator Hawley's probably thought more about that than I have, and I'm not prepared to say it's not a good idea. I just think it's going to be first pursued by the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that may be a good place to start.
Last point on this, should Robert Mueller testify in Capitol Hill?
I don't have a problem with that. I think his judgment on that would be good. I was confident that his judgment would produce a fair report.
And you think it has.
And I believe it has. I don't know any reason that he should not testify unless he thinks there's questions regarding ongoing prosecution of cases or something that relate to that. But I suspect he'll be as smart as the people questioning him, so he could probably answer those questions by saying, I can't talk about that part of this. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with the idea of him testifying before the Congress.
Let's turn to the recent round of flooding. Lots of questions about the Army Corps of Engineers and its management of the Missouri River. This comes up, you know better than I, every time we have flooding in our state. The concern from both sides of the aisle is that the Corps should focus first on flood control and not environmental concerns and other priorities. Do you agree with that?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. Now, I don't think the other priorities are not significant. I just think we've got the priorities reversed in recent years. And I don't think it's the Kansas City Corps. You know, the Corps has to manage the plan they're given. And I think it's an important – it might be the right time to finally really look at that Missouri River management plan. Look at the economy we're approaching. World food demand is going to double between now and 2050. Nobody is better located to take advantage of that than we are.
Right.
But the rivers are an important part of our advantage. There's no question, Steve, that the Mississippi River is about to be more important and may already be more important than it's been in 100 years. It's a more open debate about the Missouri, but if you look at what are supposedly the priorities of the river, which number one is flood control, number two is navigation, number three is drinking water, and then you get down much lower to the environmental. Those are not reflected in the way the plan has been funded or exercised. I'm talking to the civilian head of the Corps, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for the Corps, R.D. James, who's a civil engineer from the Boot Heel in Missouri, fully understands the river and levees and all of those things, as well as the EPA about how you use the Endangered Species Act in a way that tries to protect those species, but also considers the people involved. You know, we have endangered species and wildlife things on the Mississippi, but they've never been allowed to totally upset the balance of the river as an avenue of commerce. You know, when it comes to flood control, if you've got a navigable channel, it handles more water mm-hmm. than a channel where you let the gravel build up on the 9-foot channel, which is kind of the minimum navigable channel for barge traffic, it handles more water than a 7-foot channel. Just obviously that would be the case. And if you need to get things on the water, you should get them on the water as quickly as you can. If it's eventually going to go on the water, our big advantage in both that agricultural economy and in a more productive manufacturing economy would be the better integration of rail and highway and river mm-hmm. to where you're on the most efficient way to transport goods as quickly as you can, because, among other things, that saves a lot of traffic on roads and bridges.
Senator Roy Blunt is my guest. You know, you work on so many issues, Senator, but one thing that you've been working on is a move to speed up the confirmation process for presidential nominees. First, tell us how big of a problem this has become, because you've said repeatedly that Democrats are abusing this process.
Well, they have abused the process. And, you know, until 2003, when George W. Bush nominated Miguel Estrada to be a circuit judge 3 different times, every time prohibited by the 60-vote strategy from having a vote, until that point, there'd almost never been a time when nominees just didn't get a vote and get it pretty quickly. Clarence Thomas, you and I both would remember how hotly contested that was. He was confirmed for the Supreme Court 52-48
mm-hmm.
with nobody. Ted Kennedy, Joe Biden, the chairman of the committee, nobody suggesting, no, we first have to have an obstacle that this judge couldn't get over as part of the process. And then beginning in 2003, both sides more and more began to create obstacles. Democrats from 2003 to 2008. And then once this starts, there's always a, well, they were terrible, so right. we have to be equally as terrible.
Yeah.
And under President Trump, this had reached a high point that it would be impossible for the president to ever get the almost 1,000 people that have to be confirmed by the Senate confirmed. Even in a two-year presidency, mm-hmm. you couldn't have done that. And the Democrats were consistently saying no on this assistant secretary of agriculture for something. We want 30 hours of debate, but then there was no debate.
That's what they're entitled to get is 30 hours of debate on any appointee.
That's what they were entitled to get.
Mm-hmm.
We had given them in year 3 and 4 of the Obama presidency, right after I got to the Senate, we had given them the ability for most people to be confirmed with 2 hours of debate. And that was on a 2-year trial. And frankly, we just reverted back a couple of weeks ago to that same standard going forward, except mm-hmm. permanently going forward. If you're a cabinet officer, a Supreme Court judge, even a Court of Appeals judge, you get the 30 hours of debate. But when we confirmed Attorney General Barr earlier this year, less than 4 hours of debate were used. Now, we had set aside 30 and couldn't do anything else during that 30.
I was going to say, when this happens, you can't do anything else.
Can't do anything else. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And so, you know, 124 people were returned at the end of the last Congress that had been nominated for something, had gone through the whole process, had been out of the committee that investigates them, whatever that pertinent committee might be. More than half of them had been out on a bipartisan vote and had been out at least a year. And like the judge that's been nominated for the Eastern District in Missouri, a district court, I sent his name in on a panel with two other people. 24 months ago, 22 months ago, the president chose that person from the three people, had the hearing, had the background check. A year after all of that's over, still not a judge yet. And actually he's closed his legal practice because in his own unique circumstance, that's what it turned out in his small specialized practice.
And the concern would be that who wants these jobs if this is what you have to go
exactly.
through?
Exactly. And that's a lifetime job if you get it, though, you know, the longer it takes, the less lifetime you have left. But the judge, like these jobs that are the assistant secretary of transportation for aviation or something that have to be confirmed, who would put their life on hold for that?
Yeah.
And also it prevents the president from doing what the president was elected to do, any president, and that's get a chance to take over the top confirmed echelons of the government and do the things you were elected to do. And so we had 53 Republican senators, 51 of us agreed that it was time to put a stop to that. And so, like I said, the jobs that you would think might take a substantial debate will still have that. The others won't. Let me give you one other statistic.
I got 10 seconds, Senator.
When Reagan was president, it was 5 days after you got out of committee before you got a vote. When Trump was president, 55 days average after you got out of committee. And so the system's being abused, and we have ended that abuse.
That's Missouri Senator Roy Blunt. Never enough time to get to all the issues I wanted to get to, but Senator, thanks for your time today.
Great
I sure
to be
appreciate
with you,
it. You bet. Tomorrow on the show, Missouri was once covered by nearly 15 million acres of tall grass prairies. Now hardly any remains. We'll learn about the negative impact that loss has had on our ecosystem. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.